Chapter 28. Bread and Cheese. Matt knew he was in trouble from the day he moved into the Tarasin Palace. He could have refused. Just because the flaming dice started or stopped did not mean he had to do anything. Usually when they stopped spinning, it was too late not to do something. The problem was, he wanted to know why. Before very many days, he wished he had taken his curiosity by the throat and throttled it. After Nynaeve and Elaine left his room, once he could manage to reach his feet without his head falling off, he spread the word among his men. Nobody seemed to see the disadvantages. He just wanted to prepare them, but nobody listened.
"Very good, my lord," Nerim murmured, tugging Matt's boot onto his foot. "My lord will finally have decent rooms. Oh, very good."
For a moment, he seemed to lose his mournful expression. For just a moment.
"I will brush the red silk coat for my lord. My lord has stained the blue rather badly with wine."
Matt waited impatiently, put on the coat, and headed down the hall.
"Aes Sedai,"
Nalesian muttered as his head popped out at the top of a clean shirt. His round-bellied manservant, Lopin, was hovering behind him.
"Burn my soul, I don't much like Aes Sedai, but the Tarasin Palace, Matt."
Matt winced. Bad enough the man could drink a barrel of brandy with no effect the next morning, but did he have to grin so?
"Ah, Matt, now we can forget dice and play cards with our own kind."
He meant nobles, the only ones who could afford to play, except for well-to-do merchants, who would not remain well-to-do long if they began betting for the stakes nobles did. Nalesian rubbed his hands briskly while Lopin tried to settle his laces. Even his beard seemed eager.
"Silk sheets," he murmured.
Whoever heard of silk sheets? Those old memories nudged, but Matt refused to listen.
"Full of nobles,"
Vannin growled downstairs, pursing his lips to spit. His glance searching for Mistress Annan was automatic now. He decided instead to swallow from the mug of rough wine that was his breakfast.
"Be good to see the Lady Elaine again, though," he mused.
His free hand rose as if to knuckle his forehead. He did not seem aware of the gesture. Matt groaned. That woman had ruined a good man.
"You want me to look in on Carradine again?" Vannin
went on, as if the rest was unimportant.
"His street's so full of beggars, it's hard to see anything. But he has an awful lot of folk come to call."
Matt told him that would be fine. No wonder Vannin did not care whether the palace was full of nobles and Aes Sedai. He would spend the day sweating in the sun and jostled by the crowds. Much more comfortable. There was no point trying to warn Harnan and the rest of the Red Arms, all shoveling down white porridge and tiny black sausages while they nudged one another in the ribs and laughed about the serving women in the palace, who, they had heard, were all chosen for their beauty and remarkably free with their favors. A true fact, they kept assuring themselves. Things did not get any better when he went into the kitchens searching for Mistress Annan to settle the bill. Kyra was there, but, with all her bad temper of the night before, doubled. She stuck out her lower lip, glowering at him, and stalked out the door to the stable yard, rubbing the back of her skirt. Maybe she had gotten herself into some misery or other, but how she could blame Matt Cawthon was beyond him. Mistress Annan was out, it seemed. She was always organizing soup kitchens for refugees or leaping into some other good work, but Enid was waving a long wooden spoon at her scurrying helpers and ready to take his coin in her stout hand.
"You squeeze too many melons, my young lord, and you shouldn't be surprised when a rotten one breaks in your hand," she said darkly for some reason.
"Or two,"
she added after a moment, nodding. She leaned close, tilting up her sweating round face with an intense stare.
"You'll only make trouble for yourself if you say a word. You won't."
That did not sound like a question.
"Not a word," Matt said.
What in the light was she talking about? It seemed the right response, though, because she nodded and waddled away, waving that spoon twice as vigorously as before. For a moment, he had thought she meant to thump him with it. The pure truth was, women all had a violent streak, not just some of them. One thing and another, it was a relief when Narum and Lopin got into a shouting match over whose master's baggage would be carried over first. Smoothing their feathers required a good half an hour from him and Elysian both. A manservant with his dander ruffled could make your life miserable. Then he had to settle which of the Red Arms were to have the honor of lugging the chest of gold across, and which were to take the horses. Anyway, it was that much longer outside the bloody Tarasan Palace. Once he was ensconced in his new rooms, though, he almost forgot troubles at first. He had a large sitting room, and a small, what they called a sulking room hereabouts, and an immense bedchamber with the biggest bed he had ever seen, the massive bedposts carved with entwined flowers of all things and painted red. Most of the furniture was bright red or bright blue, where it was not layered with gilt. A small door near the bed led to a cramped room for Narim, which the fellow seemed to think was excellent despite a narrow bed and no window. Matt's rooms all had tall arched windows letting onto white wrought iron balconies that overlooked the Malhara. The stand lamps were gilded, and so were the mirror frames. There were two mirrors in the sulking room, three in the sitting room, and four in the bedchamber. The clock, a clock, on the marble mantel above the fireplace in the sitting room, sparkled with gilt as well. The wash basin and pitcher were red seafolk porcelain. He was almost disappointed to discover that the chamber pot under the bed was only plain white pottery. There was even a shelf in the large sitting room with a full dozen books. Not that he read much. Even given the jarring colors of walls and ceilings and floor tiles, the rooms shouted rich. Any other time, he would have danced a jig. Any time when he was not aware that a woman with chambers right down the hall wanted to stick him in hot water and put a bellows to the fire. If Teslin or Merlilla or one of that lot did not manage it first, despite his medallion. Why had the dice in his head stopped tumbling as soon as Elaine mentioned these bloody rooms? Curiosity. He had heard a saying on several women's lips back home, usually when he had done something that looked fun at the time. Men teach cats curiosity, but cats keep sense for themselves. "I'm no bloody cat," he muttered, stalking out of the bedchamber into the sitting room. He just had to know. That was all.
"Of course you're not a cat," Tylan said. "You're a succulent little duckling, is what you are."
Matt gave a start and stared.
"Duckling? And a little duckling at that?" The woman stood well short of his shoulder. Indignation or no indignation, he managed an elegant bow anyway. She was the queen. He had to remember that.
"Majesty, thank you for these wonderful apartments. I'd love to talk with you, but I have to go out and..."
Smiling, she advanced across the red and green floor tiles, layered blue and white silk petticoats swishing, large dark eyes fixed on him. He had no desire at all to look at the marriage knife nestled in her generous cleavage, or the larger, gem-studded dagger thrust behind an equally gem-studded belt. He backed away.
"Majesty, I have an important..."
She started humming. He recognized the tune. He had hummed it to a few girls lately. He was wise enough not to try actually singing with his voice, and besides, the words they used in Ebu Dar would have singed his ears. Around here they called it, "I will steal your breath with kisses." Laughing nervously, he tried to put a lapis-inlaid table between them, but she somehow got around it first without seeming to increase her speed.
"Majesty, I..."
She laid a hand flat on his chest, back-heeled him into a high-backed chair, and plumped herself down on his lap. Between her and the chair arms, he was trapped.
Oh, he could have picked her up and set her on her feet quite easily, except that she did have that bloody big dagger in her belt, and he doubted his manhandling her would be as acceptable to her as her manhandling him seemed to be. This was Ebu Dar, after all, where a woman killing a man was justified until proven otherwise. He could have picked her up easily, except... He had seen fishmongers in the city selling peculiar creatures called squid and octopus, Abudari actually ate the things.
But they had nothing on Tylan. The woman possessed 10 hands. He thrashed about, vainly trying to fend her off, and she laughed softly. Between kisses, he breathlessly protested that someone might walk in, and she just chuckled. He babbled his respect for her crown, and she chortled. He claimed betrothal to a girl back home who held his heart in her hands. She really laughed at that.
"What she does not know cannot harm her," she murmured, her 20 hands not slowing for an instant. Someone knocked at the door.
Prying his mouth free, he shouted, "Who is it?" Well, it was a shout, a high-pitched shout. He was out of breath, after all. Tylan was off his lap and 3 paces away so fast it seemed she was just here, then there. The woman had the nerve to give him a reproachful look, and then she made a kiss at him. That barely left her lips before the door opened and Tom stuck his head in.
"Matt? I wasn't sure that was you." "Oh, Majesty."
For a scrawny old gleeman with pretensions, Tom could flourish a bow at the best in spite of his limp. Julin could not, but he snatched off his ridiculous red hat and did what he could.
"Forgive us. We won't disturb—"
Tom began, but Matt broke in hurriedly. "Come in, Tom." Snatching his coat back on all the way, he started to stand, then realized that somehow the bloody woman had untied the waist of his breeches without him noticing. These two might miss that his shirt was undone to his belly, but they would not miss his breeches falling off. Tylan's blue dress was not mussed at all. "Julin, come in."
"I am glad you find the rooms acceptable, Master Cawthon," Tylan said, dignity incarnate.
Except for her eyes, anyway, when she stood so Tom and Julin could not see them. Her eyes laced innocuous words with added meaning.
"I look forward to having your company with pleasure. I shall find it interesting, having a Taviran where I can reach out and touch him at will. But I must leave you to your friends now. No, do not stand. Please."
That with just the hint of a mocking smile.
"Well, boy," Tom said, knuckling his mustaches when she was gone, "there's luck for you, being welcomed with open arms by the queen herself."
Julin became very interested in his cap. Matt eyed them warily, mentally daring them to say a word more. Just one word. But once he asked after Nynaeve and Elaine, he quit worrying what they suspected. The women were not back. He almost leaped up, breeches or no. They were trying to wiggle out of their agreement already. He had to explain what he meant in between their outbursts of incredulity, in between expressing his opinions of Nynaeve, bloody Almira, and Elaine, bloody daughter heir. Not much chance they would have gone off to the Rahad without him, but he would not put it past them to try their hand spying on Caradhyn. Elaine would demand a confession and expect the man to break down. Nynaeve would try to beat one out of him.
"I doubt they are bothering Caradhyn," Julin said, scratching behind his ear. "I believe Avienda and Brigitte are taking a look at him, from what I heard. We didn't see them go. I do not think you need to worry about him knowing what he's seeing, even if he walks right by them."
Tom, pouring himself a golden goblet of wine punch that Matt had found waiting, took up the explanation. Matt put a hand over his eyes. Disguises made with the power. No wonder they had slipped away like snakes whenever they wanted. Those women were going to make trouble. That was what women did best. It hardly surprised him to learn that Tom and Julin knew less about this bowl of winds than he did. After they left to ready themselves for a trip to the Rahad, he had time to set his clothes to rights before Nynaeve and Elaine came back. He had time to check on Alvar in his room one floor down. The boy's skinny frame had fleshed out somewhat, with Enid and the rest of the cooks at the Wandering Woman stuffing him, but he would always be short, even for a Kyrianan. And if his ears shrank to half their size and his mouth to half its width, his nose would still stop him well short of handsome. No fewer than 3 serving women fussed over him while he sat cross-legged on his bed.
"Matt, don't you think Hazel has the most beautiful eyes?" Ulver said, beaming at the big-eyed young woman Matt had met the last time he came to the palace. She beamed back and ruffled the boy's hair. "Oh, but Alice and Loya are so sweet, I could never choose."
A plump woman just short of her middle years looked up from unpacking Ulver's saddlebags to give him a broad grin, and a slender girl with bee-stung lips patted the towel she had just put on his washstand, then flung herself onto the bed to tickle Ulver's ribs till he fell over laughing helplessly. Matt snorted. Harnan and that lot were bad enough, but now these women were encouraging the boy. How was he ever going to learn to behave if women did that? Ulver ought to be playing in the streets like any other 10-year-old. He had had no serving women falling over him in his rooms. Tylin had seen to that, he was sure. He had time to check on Ulver and to look in on Harnan and the rest of the Red Arms, sharing a long room lined with beds not far from the stables, and to saunter down to the kitchen for some bread and beef. He had not been able to face that porridge back at the inn. Still, Nynaeve and Elaine had not returned. He finally looked over the books in his sitting room and began reading the travels of Jayen Farstrider, though he barely made out a word for worrying. Tom and Julin came in, just as the women finally bustled in, exclaiming over finding him there, as if they thought he would not keep his word. He closed the book gently, set it gently on the table beside his chair.
"Where have you been?"
"Why, we went for a walk,"
Elaine said brightly, blue eyes wider than he remembered seeing before. Tom frowned and produced a knife from his sleeve, rolling it back and forth through his fingers. He very markedly did not so much as glance at Elaine.
"We had some tea with some women your innkeeper knows," Nynaeve said. "I won't bore you with talk about needlework."
Julin started to shake his head, then stopped before she noticed.
"Please, don't bore me," Matt said dryly.
He supposed she knew one end of a needle from the other, but he suspected she would as soon stick one through her tongue as talk about needlework. Neither woman cracked her teeth about civility, confirming his worst suspicions.
"I've told off two fellows to walk out with each of you this afternoon, and there will be two more tomorrow and every day. If you're not inside the palace or under my nose, you'll have bodyguards. They know their turns already. They'll stay with you at all times. All times. And you will let me know where you're headed. No more making me worry till my hair falls out."
He expected indignation and argument. He expected weaseling over what they had or had not promised. He expected that demanding this whole loaf might get him a slice at the end. A butt slice, if his luck was in. Nynaeve looked at Elaine. Elaine looked at Nynaeve.
"Why, bodyguards are a wonderful idea, Matt," Elaine exclaimed, her cheek dimpling in a smile. "I suppose you were right about that. It's very smart of you to have your men all ready to a schedule."
"It is a wonderful notion," Nynaeve said, nodding enthusiastically. "Very smart of you, Matt."
Tom dropped the knife with a muffled curse and sat sucking on a nicked finger, staring at the women. Matt sighed. Trouble. He had known it. And that was before they had told him to forget the Rahad for the time being. Which was how he found himself on a bench in front of a cheap tavern not far from the riverfront called the Rose of the Elbar, drinking from one of the dented tin cups chained to the bench. At least they washed the cups out for each new patron. The stink from a dyer's shop across the way only raised the style of the Rose. Not that it was a shabby neighborhood, really, though the street was too narrow for carriages. A fair number of brightly lacquered sedan chairs swayed through the crowd. If far more passers-by wore wool and perhaps a guild vest than silk, the wool was as often well-cut as frayed. The houses and shops were the usual array of white plaster, and if most were small and even run down, the tall house of a wealthy merchant stood on a corner to his right, and on the left, a diminutive palace, smaller than the merchant's house at least, with a single green-banded dome and no spire. A pair of taverns and an inn in plain sight looked cool and inviting. Unfortunately, the Rose was the only one where a man could sit outside,
the only one in just the right spot.
Unfortunately. I doubt I've ever seen such splendid flies, Nalesian grumbled, waving away several choice specimens from his cup.
What is it we're doing again?
You are swilling that foul excuse for wine and sweating like a goat, Matt muttered, tucking his hat to shade his eyes better. I am being Taviran. He glared at the dilapidated house between the dyer's and a noisy weaver's establishment that he had been told to watch. Not asked, told. That was what it came to, however they phrased it, squirming around their pledges. Oh, they made it sound like asking, made it sound like pleading at the end, which he would believe when dogs danced. But he knew when he had been bullied.
Just be Taviran, Matt, he mimicked. I know you'll just know what to do.
Bah! Maybe Elaine's bloody daughter heir and her bloody dimple knew, or Nynaeve with her bloody hands twitching to yank her bloody braid, but he would be burned if he did. If the pig-kissing bowl is in the Rahad, how am I supposed to find it on this flaming side of the river?
I do not remember them saying, Julin said wryly, and took a long swallow of some drink made from a yellow fruit grown in the countryside. You have asked that 50 times, at least.
He claimed the pale drink was refreshing in the heat, but Matt had taken a bite of one of those lemons, and he was not about to swallow anything made from them. With his head still throbbing faintly, he himself drank tea. It tasted as if the tavern keeper, a scrawny fellow with beady, suspicious eyes, had been dumping new leaves and water in yesterday's leavings since the founding of the city. The taste suited his mood.
What interests me, Tom murmured over steepled fingers, is why they asked so many questions about your innkeeper.
He did not seem very upset at the women still keeping secrets. Sometimes he was decidedly odd.
What do Setala Anan and these women have to do with the bowl?
Women did pass in and out of the dilapidated house. A steady stream of women just about. Some well-dressed, if none in silks, and not one man. 3 or 4 wore the red belt of a wise woman. Matt had considered following some of them when they left, but it felt too planned. He did not know how Taviran worked. He had never really seen any sign of it in himself, but his luck was always best when everything was random. Like with dice. Most of those little iron tavern puzzles eluded him, however lucky he felt. He ignored Tom's question. Tom had asked it at least as often as Matt had asked how he was to find the bowl here. Nynaeve had told him to his face she had not promised to tell him every last thing she knew. She said she would tell him whatever he needed to know. She said. Watching her nearly choke from not calling him names was not nearly enough vengeance.
I suppose I should take a walk down the alley, Nalesian sighed, in case one of those women decides to climb over the garden wall.
The narrow gap between the house and the dyer lay in full view for its whole length, but another alleyway ran along behind the shops and houses.
Matt, tell me again why we're doing this instead of playing cards.
I'll do it, Matt said. Maybe he would find out how Taviran worked behind the garden wall. He went and found out nothing. By the time twilight began creeping over the street and Harnan came with a bald-headed, narrow-eyed Andoran named Watt, the only possible effect of being Taviran he had seen was that the tavern keeper brewed a fresh pot of tea. It tasted almost as bad as the old. Back in his rooms in the palace, he found a note, an invitation of sorts, elegantly lettered on thick white paper that smelled like a garden of flowers.
My little rabbit, I expect to have you for dinner tonight in my apartments.
No signature, but he hardly needed one.
Light, the woman had no shame at all.
There was a red-painted iron lock on the door to the corridor. He found the key and locked it. Then, for good measure, he jammed a chair under the latch on the door to Naram's room. He could do well enough without supper. Just as he was about to climb into bed, the lock rattled. Out in the hall, a woman laughed at finding the door secured. He should have been able to sleep soundly then, but for some reason he lay there listening to his belly grumble. Why was she doing this? Well, he knew why, but why him? Surely she had not decided to toss all decency over the barn just to bed at Taviran. He was safe now, anyway. Tylin would not batter down the door, after all. Would she? Not even most birds could get in through the wrought-iron arabesques screening the balconies. Besides, she would need a long ladder to reach that high, and men to carry it. Unless she climbed down from the roof on a rope. Or she could. The night passed, his stomach rumbled, the sun rose, and he never closed his eyes or had a decent thought. Except that he did make a decision. He thought of a use for the sulking room. He certainly never sulked. At first light, he sneaked out of his rooms and found another of the palace servants he remembered, a balding fellow named Madoc, with a smug, self-satisfied air and a shy twist to his mouth that said he was not satisfied at all. A man who could be bought. Though the startled look that flashed across his square face and the smirk he barely bothered to hide said he knew exactly why Matt was slipping gold into his hand. Blood and ashes! How many people knew what Tylin was up to? Nynaeve and Elaine did not seem to, thank the light. Though that did mean they chided him about missing dinner with the Queen, which they had learned about when Tylin inquired whether he was ill. And worse. "Please," Elaine said, smiling almost as if the word did not pain her. "You must put your best foot forward with the Queen. Don't be nervous. You will enjoy an evening with her." "Just don't do anything to offend her," Nynaeve muttered. There was no doubt with her that being civil hurt. Her brows drew down in concentration, her jaw tightened, and her hands trembled to pull her braid. "Be accommodating for once in your—" "I mean to say, remember she's a decent woman, and don't try any of your—" "Light, you know what I mean." "Nervous? Ha! Decent woman? Ha!" Neither seemed the least concerned that he had wasted a whole afternoon. Elaine patted his shoulder sympathetically and asked him please to try another day or two. It certainly was better than tramping through the Rahad in this heat. Nynaeve said the exact same thing, the way women did, but without the shoulder pat. They admitted right out that they intended to spend the day trying to spy on Cardin with Avienda, though they evaded his question of who it was they thought they might recognize. Nynaeve let that slip, and Elaine gave her such a look he thought he might see Nynaeve's ears boxed for once. They meekly accepted his stricture not to lose sight of their bodyguards, and meekly let him see the disguises they intended to wear. Even after Tom's description, seeing the pair suddenly turn into Ebudari women in front of his eyes was almost as big a shock as their meekness. Well, Nynaeve made a sickly stab at meekness, growling when she realized he had meant what he said about the Aiel woman needing no bodyguard. But she came close. Either one of these women folding her hands and answering submissively made him nervous. Both of them together, with Avienda nodding approvingly, and he was happy to send them on their way. Just to be sure, though, he ignored their suddenly flat mouths and made them demonstrate their disguises for the men he was sending along first. Venon leaped at the chance to be one of Elaine's guards, knuckling his forehead right and left like a fool. The fat man had not learned much watching on his own. Just as on the day before, a surprising number of people had come to call on Carradine, including some in silk, but that was not proof they were all dark friends. All said and done, the man was the White Cloak Ambassador. More folk who wanted to trade into Amadisia probably went to him than to the Amadisian ambassador, whoever he or she was. Venon did say two women had definitely been watching Carradine's palace, too. The look on his face when Avienda suddenly turned into a third Ebudari woman was a wonder. And also an old man, he thought, though the fellow proved surprisingly spry. Venon had not managed to get a good look at him despite spotting him three times. Once Venon and the women left, Matt sent off Tom and Julin to see what they could uncover concerning Jacob Carden and a bent, white-haired old man with an interest in dark friends. If the thief catcher could not discover a way to trip Cardin on his face, it did not exist. And Tom seemed to have a way of putting together all the gossip and rumor in a place and filtering out the truth. All that was the easy part, of course. For 2 days he sweated on that bench, with an occasional stroll down the alley beside the Dyers, and the only thing that changed was that the tea got worse again. The wine was so bad, Nalesian began drinking ale. The first day the tavern keeper offered fish for a midday meal, but by the smell, they had been caught last week. The second day, he offered a stew of oysters. Matt ate 5 bowls of that, despite the bits of shell. Brigida declined both. He had been surprised when she caught up to him in Elysian, hurrying across the Mulhara that first morning. The sun barely made a rim above the rooftops, but already people in carts dotted the square. "I must have blinked," she laughed. "I was waiting the way I thought you'd come out. If you don't mind company." "We move fast sometimes," he said evasively. Nalesian looked at him sideways. Of course, he had no idea why they had crept out through a tiny side door near the stables. It was not that Matt thought Tylan would actually leap on him in the halls in broad daylight. But then again, it never hurt to be careful. "Your company is welcome any time. Thanks." She just shrugged and murmured something he did not catch and fell in on the other side of him. That was the beginning with her. Any other woman he had ever known would have demanded to know thanks for what, and then explained why none were necessary at such length that he wanted to cover his ears, or upbraided him at equal length for thinking they were, or sometimes made it clear she expected something more substantial than words. Brigida just shrugged, and over the next 2 days, something startling occurred in his head. Normally, to him, women were to admire and smile at, to dance with and kiss if they would allow, to snuggle with if he was lucky. Deciding which women to chase was almost as fun as chasing them, if not nearly so much as catching them. Some women were just friends, of course. A few. Egwene, for one, though he was not sure how that friendship would survive her becoming Amarlin. Nynaeve was sort of a friend, in a way. If she could forget for 1 hour that she had switched his bottom more than once, and remember he was not a boy anymore. But a woman friend was different from a man. You always knew her mind ran along other paths than yours, that she saw the world with different eyes. Brigida leaned toward him on the bench. "Best be wary," she murmured. "That widow is looking for a new husband. The sheath on her marriage knife is blue. Besides, the house is over there." He blinked, losing sight of the sweetly plump woman who rolled her hips so extravagantly as she walked, and Brigida answered his sheepish grin with a laugh. Nynaeve would have flayed him with her tongue for looking, and even Egwene would have been coolly disapproving. By the end of the second day on that bench, he realized he had sat all that time with his hip pressed against Brigida's and never once thought of trying to kiss her. He was sure she did not want to be kissed by him. Frankly, considering the dog-ugly men she seemed to enjoy looking at, he might have been insulted if she had. And she was a hero out of legend whom he still half expected to leap over a house and grab a couple of the Forsaken by the neck on the way. But that was not it. He would as soon have thought of kissing Nalesian. The same as the tyrant, just exactly the same as, he liked Brigida. 2 days on that bench, up and down to trot down the alley beside the Dyer and stare at the tall wall of bare brick at the back of the house's garden. Brigida could have climbed it, but even she might have broken her neck if she tried wearing a dress. 3 times he decided on the spur of the moment to follow a woman coming out of the house, 2 wearing the red belt of a wise woman. Random chance did seem to invoke his luck. One of the wise women went around the corner and bought a bunch of shriveled turnips before going back. The other walked 2 streets over to buy a pair of big green-striped fish. The third woman, tall and dark in neat gray wool, maybe a tyrant, crossed 2 bridges before entering a large shop, where she was greeted with smiles by a skinny, bowing fellow and began supervising the loading of lacquered boxes and trays into sawdust-filled baskets that were then loaded into a wagon. By what he heard, she hoped to fetch a pretty piece of silver with them in Andor. Matt barely managed to escape without buying a box. So much for random luck. No one else had any either. Nynaeve and Elaine and Avienda made their pilgrimages to the streets around Cardin's small palace without seeing anyone they recognized, which frustrated them no end. They still refused to say who. It hardly mattered, since the people were not to be seen. That was what they said, showing him enough teeth for 6 women. The grimaces were supposed to be smiles, he thought. It was a shame Avienda seemed to have fallen in with the other two so thoroughly, but there was a moment when he was pressing them for an answer, and Elaine snapped at him, staring down her nose, and the Aiel woman whispered something in her ear. "Forgive me, Matt," Elaine said earnestly, her face going so red her hair seemed to pale. "I humbly beg pardon for speaking so. I will beg on my knees, if you wish." No surprise that her voice faltered at the end. "No need for that," he said faintly, trying not to goggle. "You're forgiven. It was nothing." The oddest thing, though, Elaine looked at Avienda the whole time she spoke to him, and did not twitch an eyelid when he replied, but heaved a great sigh of relief when Avienda nodded. Women were just strange. Tom reported that Cardin gave to beggars frequently, and aside from that, every scrap of word about him in Ebudar was the kind to be expected, depending on whether the speaker thought white cloaks were murderous monsters or the true saviors of the world. Julin learned that Cardin had purchased a plan of the Tarasan Palace, which might indicate some white cloak intention toward Ebudar, and might indicate that Pedro Nile wanted a palace for himself and intended to copy the Tarasan. If he still lived. Rumors had sprung up in the city that he was dead, but then half said Aes Sedai had killed him and half said Rand had, which showed their worth. Neither Julin or Tom had scuffed up a pebble concerning a white-haired old man with a much-worn face. Frustration with Cardin, frustration with watching the bloody house, and as far as the palace went. Matt found out how things were to go that first night when he finally got back to his rooms. Alvar was there, already fed and curled up in a chair with the travels of Jayen Farstrider by the light of the stand lamps, and not at all upset over being moved out of his own room. Medic had been as good as his word. As good as the gold he stuffed in his pouch, anyway. The sulking room now held Olver's bed. Just let Tylin try anything with a child watching her. The queen had not been idle either, though. He sneaked down to the kitchens like a fox, slipping from corner to corner, flashing downstairs, and found there was no food to be had. Oh, the smell of cooking permeated the air, roasts turning on spits in the big fireplaces, pots bubbling atop the white-tiled stoves, and cooks kept popping open ovens to prod this or that. There was just no food for Matt Cawthon. Smiling women in pristine white aprons ignored his own smiles and put themselves in his way, so he could not get near the sources of those wonderful smells. They smiled and rapped his knuckles when he tried to snatch a loaf of bread or just a bit of honey-glazed turnip. They smiled and told him he must not spoil his appetite if he was to eat with the queen. They knew. Every last one of them knew. His own blushes, as much as anything else, drove him back to his rooms, bitterly regretting that odorous fish at midday. He locked the door behind him. A woman who would starve a man might try anything. He was lying on a green silk carpet playing snakes and foxes with Alvar, when the second note was slipped under his door. "I have been told it is more sporting to take a pigeon on the wing, to watch it flutter. But sooner or later, a hungry bird will fly to the hand." "What is it, Matt?" Alvar asked. "Nothing." Matt crumpled the note. "Another game?" "Oh, yes." The boy would play the fool game all day, given a chance.
"Matt, did you try any of that ham they cooked tonight? I never tasted anything."
"Just throw the dice, Oliver. Just throw the bloody dice."
Coming back for his third night in the palace, he bought bread and olives and used milk cheese on the way, which was just as well. The kitchen still had its orders. The bloody women actually laughed out loud while they wafted steaming platters of meats and fishes just beyond his reach and told him not to spoil his bloody appetite. He maintained his dignity. He did not grab a platter and run. He made his finest leg, flourishing an imaginary cloak. "Gracious ladies, your warmth and hospitality overwhelm me." His withdrawal would have gone a deal better if one of the cooks had not cackled at his back. "The queen will feast on roast duckling soon enough, lad." Very droll. The other women roared so hard they must have been rolling on the floor. Very bloody droll. Bread and olives and salty cheese made a fine meal, with a little water from his washstand to wash it down. There had not been any wine punch in his room since that first day. Oliver tried to tell him about some sort of roasted fish with mustard sauce and raisins. Matt told him to practice his reading. Nobody slipped a note under his door that night. Nobody rattled the lock. He began to think things might turn for the better. Tomorrow was the Festival of Birds. From what he had heard of the costumes some people wore, men and women both, it might be possible Tylan would find herself a new duckling to chase after. Somebody might come out of that bloody house across from the Rose of the Yelbar and hand him the bloody Bull of the Winds. Things just had to turn for the better. When he woke for his tired third morning in the Tarasin Palace, the dice were rolling in his head.